Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an X-Tuesday episode. We'll be talking about some X-Men comics today. A couple of issues to go over. Return of Wolverine, number 4. And I'm also going to talk about Age of X-Men Alpha, which kicks off that whole universe and basically picks up after the events of X-Men Disassembled. So let's go ahead and start with Return of Wolverine number 4. It's written by Charles Soule. We have art by Declan Shalvey, colors by Laura Martin, letters by Joe Sabino. Great main cover by Steve McNiven and Sonny Goh. There's some variant covers, one by Declan Shalvey and Matt Wilson, one by Wills Portacio and Chris Sotomayor, and then one by Chris Stevens and Jason Keith. So if you remember the last issue that we covered, number 3, Wolverine had gone to the island with Anna, that supposedly Sotira had taken Anna's son, and they were just about to start searching for his son. Remember, Wolverine at this point has amnesia. We don't know how he's come back to life. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't really know where he comes from. In fact, Anna is kind of educating him and telling him things about himself that he doesn't even know. Otherwise, he wouldn't even know his name was a Wolverine. He knows he can fight. He knows he can heal. He knows he has powers. He knows he has claws. But the claws are doing something we've never seen before, and he doesn't understand it, and neither does Anna. But sometimes when he uses his claws, they seem to heat up. They get super heated and enough to ignite gasoline at one point. So something new. A new power apparently that Wolverine has. We're not sure where it comes from yet, but because of that amnesia, we saw in issue 3 that Jean Grey, using the power of Cerebro, had located Logan. You know, all this time they knew from what we saw in the Hunt for Wolverine, different series and events, that Wolverine was no longer in his grave. And so they knew he must be out there somewhere, or they suspected. But despite all her efforts, every time she looked, Jean was never able to find him, never able to get through the psychic blocks that Wolverine has in place. But with the help of Cerebro, for just an instant, Jean was able to connect and find him. And using what little information and flashes she had, she gave that information to Cypher, who was able to hack into some satellites and get a visual. And so the X-Men flew there. Very small team of X-Men, the ones who knew him best, thinking that, you know, maybe he's not quite right. Maybe there's, you know, let's go with the team that knows him best, people that he'll recognize, and make sure we can kind of bring him back into the fold. So Kitty Pryde went, Nightcrawler, Jean Grey, and I think that was it. Oh, and Iceman. Sorry. Yeah, Iceman. So those 5. Kitty Pryde, Iceman, Nightcrawler, Jean Grey, and Storm. There was 5. That's what it was. Got it. Okay, so they are there, and they land on the island. Before they can even start to search for Wolverine, they get attacked by citizens. They get attacked by armed Sotira soldiers. Say they're not wanted there. They need to leave. Tear gas and what have you. So Wolverine hears the commotion. He senses there's a battle. He heads into it. And not recognizing them, he attacks. Now, we've seen throughout the series that Wolverine has all these facets of his personality that are locked in a prison. These prison cells, you know, it looks like what you would imagine, like Alcatraz looks, where just, you know, cell upon cell upon cell. And it's not even just his personalities that are locked away there, it seems, but also the memories of all the other people he's known in his life, all these hundreds of people. We saw Sabretooth in a cell. We saw Cyclops in a cell. So on and so forth. So these different aspects of himself, the Patch personality, the Berserker personality, the Hero personality and such, well, whatever personality you want to call it that wears the brown costume is the one that kind of calls out to him when it's time to fight these X-Men, basically. And that personality says, hey, these 5 people are really powerful. If you want any chance of winning, you need to listen to me. You need to go after the elf first, the teleporter, Nightcrawler. And so he basically tells him that, you know, Nightcrawler, you won't even be able to lay a hand on him because he can teleport. But when he gets tired or stressed, he does fall back into a pattern of where he'll teleport, and you've memorized that pattern. So he's able to kind of anticipate where Nightcrawler's going to pop up next and starts throwing the punch before Nightcrawler's even there, and does manage to take him out. Next, he's supposed to take out Jean Grey using kind of the low visibility and the fog of the tear gas. But when he sneaks up on her, she senses that he's there. And before he can even do anything, Iceman is there, uses an ice blast, pins him against a tree, and is just pouring the ice on, saying, "Logan, you need to calm down. You need to calm down." And Logan, you know, it's that fight or flight mechanism. It's that never say die attitude that Wolverine has. He goes and he unlocks the Berserker, even though other aspects of his personality, other people in the prison, in his mind, basically the psychic prison, if you want to call it that, are telling him, you know, watch out for this guy because he's, you know, he's nuts. He's a Berserker. And sure enough, we see at the end of issue 3, Wolverine goes berserk and he literally cuts Iceman in half. So how Iceman will survive, I mean, is it like we've seen, it reminded me of the scene from Secret Wars, Marvel's superhero Secret Wars, the first one where the Absorbing Man had turned himself into stone, I think it was, and Wolverine cut off his arm and he didn't want to turn back into human form. He's carrying around his arm, you know, which has been turned into stone, and that arm was carrying his ball and chain that he uses as a weapon. And then basically he's like, at some point he's like, I gotta change back, because if I stay in this form, I'm gonna starve to death. And what he did was he held the stone arm next to, you know, the bicep. He had cut it off at the bicep, and he basically held it in place and transformed back, and it worked. Like he kind of reattached itself, and he mentions how, you know, it really hurt. So I guess that's how they're going to save Iceman. I'm not really sure, because here's the thing about issue 4. Issue 3 ends with that cliffhanger of Iceman literally being cut in half at the waist. But when this issue starts, Wolverine's laying in a hospital bed. And Anna's there. She's telling him to wake up. And Wolverine is literally strapped down with leather straps. And he's like, "Wait, hey, what's going on? What is this?" She tells him not to worry. "We thought you might go wild again." And he's you know, these people, they don't know you like I do. You know, I know it's safe to let you out. And so she basically lets him loose of the restraints. And he's asking her questions like, "Wild? What do you mean go wild?" And Anna's saying, "Well, you don't remember." And Wolverine says, "No, I remember I started a fight with those people. The teleporter, the redhead, but then there was some ice." And he vaguely remembers slicing Iceman in half. And he's like, that's all I remember." And so Anna tells him, well, you won. You sent them all running away. The people of the city helped, but mostly it was you. Your strength, you drove them away. You're a hero. But it came at a cost. And when they look out at the city, it's like destroyed. Like, it looks like a hurricane or a bomb went off. Buildings are melted and there's debris everywhere. And Wolverine's like, I did this. And Anna, she blames it on Storm. She says, "No, you know, the Weather Witch, the rest that chose to come, they knew the consequences, they came anyway, but you just did what you had to do. You're a hero," tells him that again. He's like, "I don't really feel like a hero. You know, how did I end up here?" So she tells him that after the fight, he was burning up. The claws were white hot, but eventually, like embers, it kind of burned out and you seemed exhausted and you were injured and you weren't healing as quickly as you normally do. Maybe the claws steal energy from your healing ability. Maybe that's what it is. But anyway, we brought you here and, you know, we wanted to make sure you were going to be okay. You know, we're grateful for you saving us. And he says, "Well, you know, whatever happened, I feel like I was hit by a Mack truck, but we need to go because we still need to find your son." Again, Wolverine with that single-mindedness. She says, "No, my son, he's here." And you're just like, "Wait, what?" All of a sudden, he's there. It was a big thing to go and find him. So he comes walking into the hospital, says his name's Perrin. "Hey, glad to meet you." Anna's overcome. She gives Wolverine a kiss, and he's like, "Whoa, hold on a second. Like, your son, like, I think he kind of senses there's something not right." And he said, but how is he here? Like, I still have a lot of questions. He was given an injection. What, you know, you worried about that? He was a human incubator. And Anna all of a sudden just seems to have all the answers. "Oh, so Tierra set him free, and, you know, this is a hospital, so..." You know, so Tierra knew after what they saw you do out there that if you were coming, that they wouldn't be able to keep my son from me. So they just let him go. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Like, wait, what? And all of a sudden, this hospital on this island just knows how to cure him of whatever it was he was injected with. And so Anna's, hey, you need to calm down, you need to relax, because, you know, Wolverine clearly senses something's not right here. And she goes on to say, I still have a couple more stories to tell you. You know, I told you that I knew three stories about you, and I've only told you one so far. And, you know, there's no reason to rush, no need to hurry. We have plenty of time. Yeah, like, plenty of time. Like, the X-Men are still here. They could be coming back. How is it there's plenty of time? Again, way more questions than answers. So she starts talking about how every day people in the city wake up, they go to work, they work, they come home, they go to sleep, and the next day they do it all over again. And that's it. Their lives seem sort of meaningless. You know, they dream when they're asleep, and that's kind of interesting, I guess, but they don't ever accomplish anything. They're wasting their time. They're wasting their effort on hopes and dreams, because the vast majority of them are never going to achieve any of these dreams. They're never going to do anything that's worthwhile. You know, they struggle forward, and they think that any hardships they overcome makes it noble, their struggle, what have you, humanity's machinery rising above. But she's like, it's more like it's just a carrot in front of a donkey, you know, that these dreams and these hopes and these wishes they have is what keeps them going. But the truth is that most of these people, they're not going to do anything with their lives, and they're just kind of machinery. They're just robots going through the motion. If you want to compare human society or mankind to a machine, these people are just the gears or the wires or lines of computer code. They don't really matter. In fact, when they're born, they're already dead. One day their body dies. And she says, isn't that sad? Doesn't it seem inefficient? I think so. I've always thought so. You just have, like, right away you get the sense, like, who the heck is this person? She's talking completely different than she's been talking previously. And again, Wolverine senses that. He's like, Anna, are you all right? And she says, don't you see? That's the story of why you're here. It's the second story I wanted to tell you about yourself. That's why you came back to life, because that story was about you. And she pulls out a gun and she shoots her son. And she's like, it's all right, Logan. Perrin's not really my son. He's not even Perrin. It's just a name that I liked. And we see the boy who's been shot, and there's blood on the ground. And then all of a sudden he just gets up, big hole gaping in his chest. And she says, I'm not even really Anna. And Wolverine's like, what the F is going on? Before he can make any move, we see that Persephone's brother, Zagius, I think his name is, or something like that, he shows up in the doorway with some kind of this harpoon-type gun, and Wolverine pops his claws, but it's too late. This harpoon skewers him, goes right through his chest, pins him to the wall, and the end of the harpoon that's sticking out of Logan's chest kind of opens up, and all these steel cables come out, and they basically pin Wolverine to the wall so he can't get any leverage. And Anna turns to him and says, you figured it out yet? And he says, Persephone. She says, very good. He's like, well, you kissed me. She's like, yeah, I would have done a lot more than that. You're such a prude. But, oh, well, maybe in our next lives. And Wolverine wants to know, well, did you kill Anna while I was asleep? She says, no, Anna was dead before you ever met her. I was just giving her a second life. But I think her name really was Anna, not like, you know, the boy over here. But Wolverine just wants some answers. Like, what are you doing? What are you trying to achieve? And this is where we start to learn much more about Persephone. So she tells Wolverine, look out the window. Everybody you see out there is like Anna and Perrin. Basically, everybody on the island, even though they seemed alive, the entire city, they were all dead. They were all dead since before Logan even got to the island. So it turns out Persephone's a mutant, and her power is to bring people back from the dead. And she can do that on some different levels. She can bring them back so they're kind of mindless zombies, she calls them, or she can return them like she returned the people of the city, where they have a little more cognition, a little more cognitive ability. She puts it this way. She says they're able to follow programs and simple instructions, but it's a bit harder for me to do that. You know, it takes more effort. She says the greatest challenge is if I really focus, I can create a facsimile of life that's so accurately it would fool your mother. So she breaks it down like this. I can bring people back as monsters, as drones, or as clones. Clones, you know, of who they were before. But again, they take more effort. Like, monsters is easiest, drones is harder, clones even harder than that. So is this Wolverine a clone? Did she bring him back but not fully, like 98%. And the, you know, the 2% is the memories. We just don't know. We still don't know what her plan is, but it's a pretty crazy power when you think about it. Super, super powerful though. So she almost seems like, to me, on the level of not quite an Apocalypse, but certainly a Mr. Sinister in terms of how important she may be going forward. So I'm for you collectors out there, X-Men collectors, I'm not sure what her first appearance is. I think it is somewhere in the Hunt for Wolverine series. So I mean, those weren't like hugely popular. A lot of people didn't pick them up. So I'm just wondering if, you know, now might be the time, if you're a speculator, to go hunt up Persephone's first appearance. I mean, I don't know, maybe she doesn't even survive this series, but she definitely seems powerful enough to be a thorn in the X-Men side going forward. So she explains a little more about, you know, when I grew up, death was all around me. It left me afraid and angry. And I thought me having these powers was like karma, like the cosmos was trying to balance things out. But it's been years and I still haven't gotten back what I lost. You know, everybody that I bring back, they can walk and they talk, but at the end of the day, they're still just me. So again, I'm not sure exactly how her powers work. Like maybe she's imbuing them with some of her life force, so in a way they're her. But she says, well, death's the only friend I've got. He's a good friend. And the city of corpses, it was really just an experiment. I wanted to see if I could do it. And, you know, people think of death as ugly or frightening, but it's beautiful because the dead don't litter. They don't fight. They don't waste. In fact, this is the most perfect city on the planet. And, you know, I tested it out to see if it would work. And it worked for one simple reason. The dead do what they're told. Wolverine's like, well, yeah, because they're dead. This is an abomination. This isn't life. And Anna's like, well, you know, Persephone, you do what you got to do. So then he asks, well, what about the people who attacked the city? Who are they? You know, now he's starting to realize maybe those were the good guys. And she says, oh, they called themselves X-Men. They were some of your best friends in the world, if you must know, but maybe not anymore, especially since you like cut one in half. But, you know, the Weather Witch came in and kind of knocked you away and saved him, kept him alive, as far as I know. But basically, after that, we were able to take out Jean Grey with her distracted. And that left only Kitty Pryde able to fight. And basically, I gave her an ultimatum. I told her that they were warned from coming here and that Logan, you, belonged to me. And they all needed to leave. Or I was going to have you slaughter every man, woman, and child on the island. So the X-Men had no choice but to retreat. And once they left, all that was left for Persephone to do was to take down Wolverine, who, again, was in that berserker rage. So Persephone says it did take quite a bit of work to calm him down. And in fact, Wolverine apparently took out about a third of the population. And all that damage that we saw was from Wolverine and the helicopters, you know, firing missiles and bullets and that kind of thing. So most of the damage wasn't done by the X-Men, despite what Persephone had told him earlier. But when he hears that, you know, he gets pretty upset. He wants to take her out. He's like, what, you're gonna slice me up? Because this is just Anna. So you kill this body, you're not going to learn anything. So you might want to come and see me. That might be a better idea. And she says, Zagoras can bring you. Or if you don't want to come and learn, you can come and try to kill me if you want. But either way, come to save the world or come to meet the devil. You know, that's your choice. But I do still owe you one more story. So don't you want to see how it ends? And then she basically leaves Anna's body and we see Anna's eyes roll back up into her head and she falls down dead next to her son. So Wolverine turns to Zagoras and says, you can drop dead too if you want to. And he just stares at him. And, you know, Zagoras, he's got this full face mask. All you see is his eyes. But you do notice around his eyes, the flesh seems decayed or burnt or something. So I'm sure her brother is not alive fully either. Maybe, you know, more so than anybody else, especially because she probably knew him really, really well. So what part of herself she imbued in him probably is pretty close to who he is, but I have a feeling he's not really fully alive either. So anyway, Wolverine says, all right, I accept the invitation. Let's go. Get me out of this thing. And they start walking outside to the Humvee. And Wolverine says, what'd she call you again? Zagoras? Well, let me tell you something, Zaggy. I already know how the story ends. Somebody dies. And where they're going is actually to a space shuttle or some kind of a spaceship, if you will, some kind of a it kind of looks like a space shuttle, but a little smaller. It's got booster rockets and all that. So clearly they're going out of Earth's atmosphere. Clearly Persephone's in orbit, or she's on the moon, or she's somewhere. So next is the end. There's only one issue left, and we're going to get some answers. So interesting issue. It really turned. I mean, it felt like the way that issue 1, 2, and 3 were paced, that everything was going to happen in the city. Like, you would have thought that, or I would have thought that the X-Men would have somehow got through to Wolverine, through to Logan during the fight, and then they all would have gone after Persephone, and she probably would have escaped, saved the son of Anna, or who we thought was Anna, and then Persephone makes her escape, you know, lives to fight another day. Instead, we get a big time jump in between issues 3 and 4, and we miss out on the actual battle. We get a little bit of it in flashbacks. So I'm not sure how I feel about that, because all of a sudden the narrative, the whole momentum of the story has shifted. So it's very interesting story structure from Charles Soule here, and I'd be curious to talk to Charles about why he set the story up this way. I mean, I guess if you only have 5 issues to tell the story you want to tell, and you want to hit certain story beats, like, you know, Wolverine waking up in a cave with you know, saber-toothed tiger and a woolly mammoth fighting each other, to get from there to fighting Persephone in space, that's a lot to fit into 5 issues. We do know that Steve McNiven was supposed to do the art for the whole series. He's not the fastest artist in the world, so he only ended up doing the 1st and 5th issue. And we had Declan Shelby come in and do issues 2, 3, and 4. No slight against Declan Shelby. I like his art. I like his color work. I like what he does in terms of storytelling. But his art style, it's not as detailed. It's not as dynamic as Steve McNiven. So I think for this story, when you get McNiven's art in the 1st issue, it's such a treat. It's a little bit jarring to go to Declan's art. I kind of wish one or the other had just done the whole thing. So that kind of also feeds into making the story feel a little bit choppy. So it's not bad by any stretch of the imagination. But when it comes to, you know, classic X-Men stories, yes, a lot of stuff happens usually, but you can't help but think back to, you know, the golden age of X-Men with Chris Claremont, and the story never really felt choppy. Everything, every story beat, every plot had enough room and enough real estate on the page to really breathe. But again, it was a different time. I mean, we're talking bigger panels here, more focus on art, much less dialogue. I mean, that's one of the things, even back then, even, you know, during the late 70s and 80s, late 70s, early 80s, when X-Men was in that golden era, you know, John Byrne, well, starting with Dave Cockrum, Chris Claremont, John Byrne, Terry Allison on inks, obviously, Mark Silvestri, even the Jim Lee era, very dialogue heavy, a lot of dialogue. And again, comics at that time, a lot more exposition, a lot more dialogue boxes. But even then, even in that era, people were saying, man, with X-Men, even more, you know, dialogue heavy. So different time, and harder to fit that much story into a comic when you don't have as much dialogue and you're relying on the art to do a little bit more of the heavy lifting. We don't do thought balloons anymore, so that's different as well. So again, different time, but... And not that you would necessarily take this story and compare it back then, but I bring it up to kind of illustrate the point that it does. This does feel a little compressed. It does feel a little rushed in a way. I think if we could have got 7 issues, you know, we could have got the battle. It almost feels like we missed a whole issue here. Easily could have had, you know, issue 4 be the rest of the battle, and seen I don't know, we could have had a little more of Persephone and what she was planning, instead of just, you know, issue three ends with Wolverine, Logan fighting the X-Men, and then issue four, he wakes up in the hospital. So again, it's not terrible, but especially it just feels like a little bit of a cheat when you end on that cliffhanger of Iceman being cut in half, and you know, you're expecting to open up the first page of issue four and see him cut in half. Okay, how are they going to save him? That kind of thing. And then just skip over it. It just seems a little, I don't know, a little disappointing, I guess. Still enjoy it. I think that overall, I can't really give the whole series a grade or even say, you know, it's more good than bad until we get to that final issue. Final issue, Steve McNiven art. So we got that to look forward to. Plus, how's it all going to wrap up? What are we going to find out about Persephone? Does Wolverine get his full memories back? Like, how much of a payoff are we going to get? And that will go a long way towards kind of smoothing over the rough edges that there are for me in this issue four. Because up till now, I thought it was really great. But much like the Hunt for Wolverine series, it just doesn't feel like the story. Well, that story felt like we weren't getting enough information. Things were happening, but it all felt kind of pointless. I don't want to say it wasn't moving fast enough, because now here I am saying this one's moving too fast. But it just felt a little like we didn't have enough happen in that series in terms of actually getting answers about Logan, about where was Wolverine. And here we are with his return series, and he's here. It's it's his series. He's the star of it. We're still not getting enough answers, even at this breakneck pace. We still don't know why his claws heat up. We still don't know exactly who he is, how he's going to get his memories back. And when I say who he is, I mean, is he a clone? Is he actually Wolverine? Did Persephone just somehow, you know, boost his healing factor? And so he is all the way back. He's not a monster. He's not a drone. He's not a clone. Again, we don't know. So reserving judgment on this until I read the final issue. And obviously we'll be talking about that on a future episode of X Tuesday. So let's go ahead and move on to Age of X-Men Alpha number one. This one's written by Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler. We have art by Ramon Rosanas, colors by Triona Farrell, and letters by Clayton Cowles. Regular cover is by Phil Noto. We have variant covers by Araza, Wills Portacio, and Jesus Orbitov, George Perez, and Chris Sotomayor. So this is it. This is what happened after X-Men Disassembled. We saw in the final issue of that series that the X-Men supposedly were all killed. They've all disappeared from Earth, and we don't know where they are. Well, this is where they are. This is what X-Men has used the power that he was given from that artifact to basically bring another universe, another pocket dimension, I'm not exactly sure what you would call it, into being. And it is the X-Men universe. So much like Age of Apocalypse back in the day, where X-Men himself has his origins, we now have the Age of X-Men. So right inside the front cover, it says, "Welcome to a perfect world. Everyone is a mutant, special, powerful individual, no more strife, oppression, or dependence. The Age of X-Men, a dream made real, a dream that must be protected at any cost." So is that dream Xavier's dream? I mean, Xavier's dream was always to have Homo sapien and Homo superior live in harmony. What X-Men has done here, what he's used his powers to do, is actually to make everybody in the world a mutant. So we get on the first page and we see kind of everyday depictions of life. It almost seems like something straight out of Pleasantville, set in the 50s. We see a gas station, you know, full serve. They're wearing the coveralls and little paper hats. But one of the guys is blue. And then we see some firemen talking to some kids. They're sitting on the back of the truck, and one of the firemen's shooting some water out of his hand. And one of the kids has a monkey tail, and one of the other kids has giant ears. Oh, and I should mention, in the first panel at the service station, when the guy's washing the windows, he's floating up in the air to wash the windows. So clearly people have powers. Again, you just get that vibe, that 50s vibe, that, everybody is nice and, you know, everything is perfect. The next panel down, we see a man with horns growing out of his chin and his forehead, and he's got green skin. We see a waitress through the window at the diner in the background, and she's serving people food. It's all floating around her. She's clearly using telekinesis for that. So people have powers, and we get this voiceover saying, this is the age of perfection. For the first time in the world, everybody's marvelous. Everybody knows it. Mutant kind is no longer an endangered species. People believe this is Xavier's dream realized, but in reality, it's X-Man's. It's X-Man's dream realized, because again, Xavier would have wanted humans, Homo superior, Homo sapien, to live in harmony, not Homo sapiens not existing and everybody's a mutant. So X-Man goes on to say that Xavier told me a lot about his dreams. He said, the thing about dreams is most people think you can't control them, but you can. Dreams are built first and then shared, and dreams are a matter of will, of action. Like, if you want it bad enough, you can, and you have enough power, you can make it happen. And that is what X-Man has done here, but it comes at a cost. So we see the X-Men, the marvelous X-Men, because I will say that this bookend, this first issue that introduces us to the Age of X-Men, the final one is Age of X-Men Omega. This is Age of X-Men Alpha. The same writers that write this, Thompson and Nadler, they're the ones that write the Age of X-Men Marvelous X-Men series, which we'll cover in the next episode of X-Tuesday. And John Paul and I are going to talk about it. And I imagine we'll mention the fact that compared to a lot of the other Age of X-Men series, it's very, I don't want to say generic, but it kind of covers, it's very broad. It's very general. It's giving you sort of an outline of the world, whereas some of the other ones, Next Gen and Prisoner and such, they get into a lot more of the detail. So this is very much an introductory, and we're being introduced to the X-Men and the X-Men as they exist here in this reality is Jean Grey, Bishop, Storm, Nature Girl, Magneto, Colossus, Nightcrawler, and X-Man himself. So they're called. They feel that there's something going on. Jean Grey says, I haven't felt this much pain in a long time. We're right above it. Bishop brings the Blackbird down, and Nightcrawler says, I've never seen anything like this. And Bishop says, why aren't we stuck like the rest of them? Because as they look around, everybody else is just frozen. We saw that there was a cry of pain at the Museum of Mutant History, and apparently that is the cause for everybody being frozen and like time has stopped, basically. The reason it's not affecting the Marvelous X-Men is because X-Men says, I've got a psychic shield around us, so how can we help them? That's what Colossus wants to know. And Magneto says, well, it doesn't look like they're in pain. Jean says, well, they're not in pain. Somebody else is. Somebody's got a lot on their mind. And Nature Girl says, even the grass is frozen. It never stops talking. And Storm says, yeah, the air's not moving. Everything is still. And then the ground literally starts to shake and break apart. And so most of the X-Men are tasked with making sure that the people that are frozen are not hurt by what's going on with these psychic tremors. Things are starting to float in the air, cars and debris and such. And so Jean Grey reaches out to X-Men, says, I'm having trouble pinpointing her. Please help me find her, while the rest of the X-Men try to prevent anybody else from being hurt. So they sense that she's inside the Children's Memorial in the Museum of Mutant History. And sure enough, on the next page, we see she's there. Her name is Luna. And X-Men reaches out to her saying, focus on my thoughts, open your eyes, we'll get through this. And she, you know, she's kind of awakening to her powers in a new way. She's getting to be that age where her powers are manifesting in a much stronger way. She talks about the colors that are all over her brain. And she's not sure how to control it. X-Men says, well, you're having a psychic seizure. Let me in. I can help you stop it. And, you know, he calms her by saying, you know, you're so powerful. You know, with the strength, you could be part of the X-Men one day. And she's like, wow, me, that's so great. But, you know, how can I? You know, I made a big mistake. So, again, really showcasing the things that humankind fear about mutants, right? Their powers manifest, and there's an accident that could accidentally kill somebody. You talk about, you know, Rogue stealing her boyfriend's memories, or I think it was Firestar who accidentally burned her boyfriend, you know, making out with them, and, you know, those raging hormones of teenage years, and, you know, the powers get away. And but this is a different world. This is X-Man's dream. And he says, all mutants make mistakes, even myself, even the other X-Men. You're just really powerful, and people need to realize that. It's your gift, and remember, the whole world's your tribe. And so in a way, it is Xavier's dream realized, because they're safe. The mutants are safe. They can do this. They can have an accident. They can be overwhelmed by their powers. They can cause damage, but they're still not feared. They're not persecuted. So she comes out, and for the most part, everybody's okay. Nobody's been injured. The X-Men are, you know, taking pictures with other mutants. This is where we see that Colossus actually has part of his arm severed. I'm not sure. I don't know how that happened. But clearly the X-Men are beloved here. So again, a stark contrast to, you know, the normal Marvel universe where they're persecuted and they're certainly not thanked when they help out. So the X-Men decide, well, this little girl can't go back to Cerebro, which is sort of the Age of X-Men world's training facilities, where mutants are born and they get their early training. But this girl Luna, she's too powerful. So X-Men says, well, we'll give her a new home. And they take her to the Summers Institute, which is basically school for mutants. So normally they start a little later, after they're 9. But even though she's a little younger than that, they're going to make an exception. So we see that Angel is the headmaster of the Institute. And X-Man gives Luna over and says, you know, early enrollment, she's really powerful, and she needs to learn to control her powers. So go inside and kind of give her a tour. We start hearing a little bit about kind of the way everything is set up here at the Summers Institute, clearly named after Cyclops. And they also mention hatcheries, though, which I'm not sure what that is at this point. But Angel does say, you know, I know they tell you all about what we do here when you come out of the hatcheries. So again, she was at Cerebro. So Cerebro, hatchery, nursery, like what exactly is that? We're going to find out, but we don't exactly know yet. But it just sounds a little creepy when you put it that way. But Angel goes on to say, you know, we started out as a humble private school. It's actually evolved into a community where we teach people individual learning, progressive thinking. In the history department, you're going to learn about the first mutants that took up the cause of Xavier's dream and hear how the X-Men sacrificed themselves during the resolution, and that's in quotes, and the resolution is in bold letters. So clearly that is a big event that we need to be filled in on. He also tells her about the medical department, where they learn to use mutant powers to benefit society, and they're always looking for ways to improve mental health, mental science, natal solution, secondary mutation. And Luna says, what's a natal solution? And Angel says, it's how you were born. So that, coupled with hatcheries? Wait, what? So again, we're getting some vibes here that, man, maybe this isn't the perfect world that it seems to be, or I don't know. You just get a little bit of a weird vibe here. He also tells her about the civil management department, where they teach students how to keep and well manage the peace. And we see that Sunfire is teaching that. It's mutant powers and ethics, fire evacuation procedures. And we see for the first time in this Age of X-Men world, these three concepts of identity, autonomy, and harmony. And we're going to see that those three words, those themes, come up again and again. Whether or not it's true, we're going to probably break that down and be talking about that quite a bit. Are they really getting to be who they are? Are they really being true to their own identities? Do they really have autonomy? Are they making their own decisions? I would say they seem to be living in harmony. That's for sure. Next, he takes Luna outside, shows her the last section, which is the agricultural section. We see Glob is there, and apparently their farms at the Summers Institutes account for 7% of the world's agricultural output. So not sure why they need to be the ones to help make food, but apparently their sister schools contribute another 30%. So if you couldn't tell, this is our biggest department. Most students want it to be part of our little revolution. So Luna's appears to be, you know, excited to be there. And we see Glob kind of staring at her, and he just seems not quite right. He seems a little off as he hears Warren tell Luna that you'll flourish, you might even fly, you'll get to the moon that you were named after, and I guarantee these will be the best years of your life. You'll remember everything. A little ominous foretelling there as Glob looks on. So meanwhile, X Sanctuary, which is basically the X-Men's headquarters, again, we see on the outside of the building, identity, autonomy, harmony. And Jean talks about how she hasn't felt that much energy surging through her in a long time. Her muscles feel like they're on fire. And X-Men are just winding down basically after that event, I guess, that they had to calm. So Jean Grey says, Bishop, you know, you're free to go. And they're all talking about the day that everybody became a mutant. Nitro wants to know if it's as crazy as today. And Magneto says, oh, you can't even imagine. We found an entire city under the Atlantic Ocean, transported there by an 8-year-old boy who lost his mother. There were riots in St. Petersburg. People thought it was a chemical weapon. But, you know, you can't comprehend. You know, I saw an infant with the power of a black hole in his hands. It just, you know, the sounds of stretching bones. And so it sounds like whatever happened, or whatever they believe happened, maybe it happened because of X-Man just snapping his fingers and giving everybody mutant power. So clearly everybody has powers. Everybody is a mutant that's alive in this universe, on this world. But apparently it wasn't always that way. There are people that remember a time before and they remember that day. So X-Man kind of, I don't know if he doesn't want him talking about it, or he's just trying to maintain the peace and the harmony, if you will. But he says, I think what Klaus is trying to say is the world changed quickly, but we're here now, and that's all past us, and that's what matters. So Bishop says, you know, I lived through enough broken timelines. I never thought we'd get here, but if you excuse me, I'm gonna go and have a drink. So the party kind of breaks up, if you will, and we see as Bishop passes by Jean, he kind of reaches out and they brush hands. But don't hold hands. So it seems a little strange, like little hint that maybe there's something going on between Jean and Bishop. Meanwhile, we see all the other X-Men, they all retreat to their separate quarters, I guess. They're all indicated by different, they each have their own panel on the page, and it's each colored a different color. Purple for Storm, orange for X-Men, green for Nature Girl, and so on and so forth. So it's interesting. They're all relaxing, but they're all separate. They're all individual. Except when we see what I imagine is Jean's space, she's not there, and she's in fact with Bishop. And they're sitting on the couch, eating popcorn, and Jean wants to know what's on Bishop's mind. He says, I think you know. I need to tell you something. And she plants one on them, and they start making out. So, okay. Never knew there was an attraction between Bishop and Jean Grey before. clearly in this reality, there's something to that. So they wake up a little later, or at least maybe they're never asleep, but they're in bed. Bishop sits up, and Gene says, "Is this what you meant when you said you needed some R&R?" And Bishop says, "Something's not right. I really need to. And Gene says, "You know, we don't have to stop. The others won't find out. Like, why would it matter? Why would the others care?" Bishop says, "You know, I just can't help but feel like this was a mistake, but a mistake I've made before." And Gene says, "You know, I can sense your worry, but it's only natural." And then here we get the bombshell from Bishop. He says, "No, haven't we evolved beyond this, beyond romance, beyond coupling? We can't go backwards. We know that individuals, you know, we know we're stronger together," is what Gene says. "We're stronger together. We shouldn't be apart." And Bishop says, I don't know. I feel like we've done this before." And Gene says, "Well, obviously. So apparently, you know, it's a thing. They are a thing." And Bishop says, "No, I don't mean like that. I need to be alone. I need to clear my head. Good night." And he leaves. So that line he says about, haven't we evolved beyond this, beyond romance, beyond coupling? So apparently in this world, in the Age of X-Men world, there's no marriage. There's no being in love. There's no physical intimacy. I guess that would explain why you would have to have your kids in hatcheries. So we also learn on the following couple pages that Nightcrawler is apparently a very famous actor. We'll learn more about that in the Amazing Nightcrawler series. Meanwhile, Bishop is back at his quarters, and he's thinking about the past. He's thinking, Strife's dead, Magneto's one of us, other villains are all gone, we live in peace. But I still don't feel like my mind is at ease. I can't handle not doing something I never could. It's like, you know, being on the verge of needing to be on the defense all the time. There's all this energy that runs through me, and I can't shut it off. For everybody else, you know, this peace, this harmony of the world that we live in, which makes things still, it allows them to think about the future, but I can't look forward to the future because I know there's something wrong in the past. So I just don't know. I don't know what to think. You know, thinking about history, talking about history, it makes people uncomfortable. So nobody does it anymore. I don't understand why I'm the only one that wants to look back and examine the past. And as he's having these thoughts, we see some people bust through the door. It appears to be Iceman, Psylocke, and Kitty Pryde. And Psylocke yells out, "Lucas Bishop, you've engaged in a forbidden relationship." Iceman says, "This is your third breach of the guiding principles." And we get a little asterisk with, what are they talking about? See Extremist number one to find out. So they clearly are there to arrest him. So Bishop says, "I figured somebody would come, but I didn't think it would be you, Bobby." He says, "Don't do it, man. You're caught. Give up." But of course he runs, because everybody runs. And he doesn't get to his weapons in time. Psylocke is able to basically stick her psychic dagger through his head and kind of knock him out. And we see that this third person, I thought it was Kitty Pryde, actually it's not. Somebody named Moneta, because we see that as she walks into his bedroom where he was fleeing to, her fingers start to grow. They look like these little roots. And she says, "Let's see what's hiding in that dome. Memories never lie. I can't believe I'm about to do this, one of the X-Men." And it's like these little tendrils that her fingers turn into. Basically, one goes up his nostril, one goes in his ear, and she says, "Hold him, I'll connect to his limbic system." And she sees his memories. She sees him and Jean kissing on the beach. And her response is, "I've seen more than enough. You're disgusting, a disgrace, both of you." And Bishop tries to, you know, fall on the sword, take the blame. He says, it wasn't her. I'm the one that wanted this. I was begging. And Moneta says, well, not based on what I saw. And she asks what Psylocke's read is. And he says, well, I think he's lying just like the last time. So what are they going to do with Jean? Well, she's set for reconditioning. They're going to deal with Bishop first. So as they're about to put a collar on him, saying this little device is going to make you lose everything that makes you you. So again, we're talking perfect world, X-Men. We're talking, you know, harmony and autonomy, individuality. I'm not seeing that. Not seeing much harmony when you're talking about getting attacked in your own house. Outwardly, there's harmony. In public, it seems there's harmony, but certainly there's no autonomy. You can't even decide if you want to be with somebody. So right as they're about to put this onto him, Bishop uses his foot and he trips some kind of something or other. Don't know what it is, but we see him basically start to disintegrate just as the collar has been put on him. And they say, Lucas Bishop, you've been excommunicated. And he seems to sort of disintegrate. Where did he go? We need to read Prisoner X number one to find out. So the next day, we see Jean is outside the X Sanctuary. Storm comes up saying, lost in thought again. Yeah, I've been thinking how much Scott would have liked to have been here, and Logan and Xavier, all of them. And Storm says, well, they died so we could live, you know? Come on, we don't want to be late. Let's see what today's going to bring. And they head inside. And what's interesting is when they get there, Jean says, you know, I feel like something's a little off. Something's wrong. Are we missing somebody? And the rest of the X-Men look around. No. Everybody's here, so I don't know why you would think that. And we see a portrait on the wall that has Magneto, Storm, Nightcrawler, Nature Girl, X-23, Colossus, Jean Grey, and X-Man. And we saw that portrait previously when we first visited X Sanctuary, and Bishop was in the picture as well, but now he's been removed. So X-Men says, now that we're all here, something a little strange was brought to my attention last night. I want you all to see it. Last night, while they were dropping off cookies, Department X gave me this, and they said they found it near Union Square in New York. And it's a flyer, and it has Apocalypse on it, and it says, it's okay to love. Come see what you've been missing. So clearly there's some sort of resistance or something going on. And Magneto even says, this is no laughing matter. This is the language of a revolutionary. And we're told that we'll learn more about that in Apocalypse and the Extracts, number one. So it's interesting if the case is that Apocalypse is one that remembers, just like Bishop did. It's kind of flipping the script, if you will. The X-Men are really the bad guys here. I mean, really, when you think about it, it's X-Man himself who appears to be the bad guy, because Jean doesn't, not only does she not remember being intimate with Bishop, she doesn't even remember that he existed. So clearly there's some kind of mind control. There's some kind of brainwashing going on. You know, it's not the most original thing here. Clearly it's some sort of fascist state. We're talking like a lot of different sci-fi tropes mixed in. The whole idea of, you know, Stepford Wives, Stepford X-Men here, X-Men being born in laboratories, no physical intimacy, no relationships, people giving lip service to individuality, but not the freedom to make your own choice and live your life as you will. It almost seems like instead of saying individuality, they should be saying isolationism, you know, because I think it's telling when the X-Men go to retire to their various quarters after they've, you know, dealt with the situation that Luna caused, the young mutant that was really powerful and was having the psychic seizure. None of them are spending any time together except for Bishop and Jean Grey, and Bishop gets, I don't even know what, arrested for it or disintegrated. That's not okay. That's not freedom. That's not individuality. That's not being able to choose, you know, how to live your life. I think, you know, again, I understand these are Homo superior, not Homo sapiens, but they're still human beings in my mind. And it's our connections, it's our relationships, it's that's what makes us special, that's what makes life worth living. I don't think that this is what Xavier had in mind. Again, the harmony, outwardly the harmony appears to be there. And as I mentioned when I was going through the story, we certainly see that the persecution and the danger for the mutants is gone. You know, that's illustrated by the fact that Luna had that psychic scream and there was damage and people were put in danger, but she's not persecuted for it. She's not, you know, people are not in fear of her. They understand, you know, it wasn't her fault. They're going to take her to the training center, the Summers Institute, early to make sure it doesn't happen again. They're going to help her learn how to control her powers. So in that way, that part of Xavier's dream has come true. But I certainly don't think that Professor X would be on board with people losing their ability to think for themselves and to look at the past and to learn from the past and to be able to have relationships. I mentioned Stepford, I mentioned Pleasantville. You know, that might be the best Pleasantville. That might be the best comparison you could give it to. You know, that movie with Tobey Maguire, where people are not allowed to be individual. You know, everything is in black and white, and they're not allowed to come to life. And you know, everything is the 50s and boring and safe. And there's no, that's no way to live. Like, how are you gonna evolve? How are you going to grow as a person, as a species? For X-Man, you know, this is his perfection. This is his vision of Xavier's dream. And you can't help but think about how much it's influenced by where he's come from, right? Like I mentioned before, he came from that age of apocalypse. He was born in a lab. He didn't grow up with a mother and a father. You know, he didn't learn about emotion and love and connection. He was born in a lab in this post-apocalyptic, horrific, terrible world. And so for him, the safety of this world, even though it comes at basically at the cost of fascism, to him, it's probably better than the alternative, which, you know, he saw in the world or universe he came from, the world of Age of Apocalypse. And what he was seeing in the regular Marvel universe, in the regular world, what he was preaching against in the X-Men Disassembled storyline in the weekly Uncanny X-Men series, where he's saying, yes, I understand we've given lip service to humans and mutants living together, but that's all it is. We're still persecuted even after all this time, even after all these years of Xavier's dream and saving the world time and time again, and it's not good enough. And he goes beyond even in that series, in that story, he goes beyond even saying the problem is mutants and humans can't get along. You know, he's trying to save the environment, saying, look how we've destroyed the planet. And, you know, he sends Magneto out to take the weapons of war away from two Eastern European countries that are fighting against each other, and saying it's not just, you know, humans killing mutants, it's humans killing humans. It's war, along with the destruction of the environment and disease and famine. It's all those things. And so it's no surprise to see here at the Summers Institute, when you start talking about the kind of the different departments that are there, well, we've got the medical department because we want to cure diseases. We've got the agricultural department because we want to make sure everybody's fed. Again, he's trying to solve those problems that he saw in the world that he was focused on with his horsemen of trying to fix. You know, you've got the X-Men themselves as kind of the law enforcement, and to make sure that there is not going to be war, there is going to be harmony, and not just harmony with each other, with everybody being a mutant and understanding sometimes your powers get away from you, especially when you're young, you're not persecuted for that, but also harmony with the planet and the environment itself. So there's a lot of good, right? You can point to a lot of things that X-Man has done that are positive, but it just seems like it's coming at a tremendous cost. And I think ultimately that might be the kind of the theme of this entire Age of X-Men storyline. Again, you know, I haven't read it all. We're in early stages here, so we'll continue to explore that as we go along. But it's interesting to think about, right? If you write down the pros and you write down the cons, you know, is it okay? How much, you know, you gotta break some eggs to make an omelet. So, you know, where do you draw the line? One of the problems, biggest problems I have with it, with the choices that X-Men has made, I mean, clearly he's coming at it from somebody who's damaged, you know, through no fault of his own. I'm not blaming him, but coming from that environment where he didn't grow up with a, you know, a mother and a father, didn't grow up learning, you know, just any sort of normal childhood, you know, he grew up in that terrible world of Age of Apocalypse. He's not the one that should be making these decisions. He needs other people. And then to go even above that, even if he had a more normal childhood and didn't set up this fascist-like a universe that he apparently has, even if it was a little less fascist, even if people did have a little more freedom of choice and true individuality, what gives him the right? Just because he has the power, you know, it's not might makes right. We've seen that, and you know, in our own real life history of the human race, that isn't a fallacy. Just because you have the power to do something doesn't mean you should. Not when it comes at the cost of other people's freedom. I mean, it's so, what he's doing is so insidious, because it's not even that he's forcing people to do what he wants them to do. He's forcing people to do what he wants them to do, and they're not even aware of it, which makes it worse. You know, it's one thing to make everybody a slave and make everybody do what you want, be like this benevolent dictator, if you will, a Dr. Doom type that's going to rule the world and say, okay, it's all one nation. You know, it's the nation of the X-Man. And we're not going to persecute mutants, and we're not going to go to war, and people are not going to starve, and everybody's just going to do their part. And if you don't, you know, we're going to throw you in jail or something like that. But at least people would still be self-aware. You know, they might go along because they're forced to, because X-Men has, you know, the power to force them to do that. But at least they would be aware. He has taken that away even. He's taken away the consciousness. He's taken away the awareness. So they don't even know that they're these Stepford mutants, basically. And so in my mind, that makes it even worse. So clearly, there's some sort of resistance with Apocalypse. We're going to learn more about that. We're going to learn more about exactly what the rules are. I'm really curious to see what happened to Bishop. So I think this is a really good start. It doesn't give us a lot of answers about what the Age of X-Men is all about, but it gives you just enough to kind of hook you and make you realize that, man, this is pretty messed up. And the fact that he decided to kind of, I should say that the writers, Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson, decided to sort of flip the script. In a way, the X-Men themselves, without being aware of it, are the bad guys. And it appears that Apocalypse may be the good guy. Because maybe he's aware, maybe he's able to sort of fight off the mind control of X-Men. So I find that to be interesting as well. When you think about, you know, I mentioned I didn't agree that this is the culmination of Xavier's dream with humans and mutants living together in harmony or peacefully. And even X-Men himself at the beginning of the issue says, this is not Xavier's dream, this is mine. This is what I see as a perfect world. But never in any world where the X-Men and mutants are no longer persecuted, if you ever thought, okay, if we ever get to that point, you were clearly going to consider the X-Men the heroes of that story, because they sacrificed and they fought for it to get to that good place. Here we are, maybe not in as good a place as we wanted, but in X-Men's mind, we've gotten there. We've gotten to that perfect world. But it turns out, maybe it's not as perfect as we thought it would be. And it turns out the X-Men aren't the heroes. They could actually be the villains. They're not aware of it. So I guess that is what gives them an out and allows them to be redeemable in terms of the story. But it's certainly an interesting take. So I thought it was, like I said, a well-written issue. I think it gives you enough to know what's going on. It gives you little hints of the other series that are coming out, and I really enjoyed it. The art by Rosanes, it's not as detailed as I would like. I'm not that familiar with his art. I don't know that I've seen a lot of it, but it's suitable for the story. It's suitable for the tone. I think that the color work, especially by Triona Farrell, it's a little muted. There's not a lot of bright colors. It doesn't like pop off the page. It kind of gives you that sense of like a Pleasantville where if they would have done it in a black and white, I think, or a grayscale, I think that would have been even better, to just kind of give that sense of everybody's kind of sedated, everybody's subdued, nobody has, you know, really strong emotions. You know, again, I know it's a scientific or a sci-fi trope, when you start talking about people being drugged to so that they'll follow the rules. You can think of that Christian Bale movie Equilibrium, where people take that pill, it keeps them from having emotions. So, you know, and it's just dreary and gray and not exciting. And, you know, same thing here. You know, there's no connection. There's a little emotion. And so, again, Triona Farrell does a great job by using these subdued colors, the color palette. You know, nothing's bright. Nothing pops off the page. And again, I think going with grayscale would have been even better. It would have been really cool to see it like that and just really see how kind of asleep everybody is, if you will. So good start. Definitely had me hooked and had me wanting to read more of the Age of X-Man and see what it's all about and see how it all winds up. So good issue by the creative team, and I definitely recommend checking it out. I mean, all the stuff's available in trade now, so or on Marvel Unlimited. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks for listening, everybody, as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.